Well, good morning. I want to welcome you who are joining us at one of our campuses. Good evening to those of you who are joining us at Lakeline PM. I'll actually be there for Lakeline PM, so looking forward to seeing all of you then. And for all of us, we've gathered here together to take on a really interesting question, a really interesting topic. We're talking about love. So love is a powerful word. It's a word that's common in our culture today. And it actually tumbled onto the Twitter feeds of millions and millions of Americans in the form of hashtag love wins. And it seems like that if love wins, I mean, it would always win. And so what's the big deal about that? Well, that was in response to a decision this summer by the U.S. Supreme Court. They handed out down a decision to basically say no states could restrict marriage to just a man and a woman, thus opening the door for people of all different kinds of orientations to marry. And some of you may say, well, why wouldn't that be good? Like, it seemed like everybody ought to have a chance to be with the one they love, to marry and to live their life and build it the way they want. Who cares what people do? Well, let me just suggest to you that it actually is a very big issue. It's a very big issue internationally on a global scale. It's a very big issue nationally. It's also a very big issue personally, and let me explain why. On the international scene, you may not be aware of this. It didn't get any press from the American media. But a month after the Supreme Court ruling, the UN Human Rights Commission, which is a global commission, affirmed traditional marriage as what countries should be promoting, building laws around. And here's what they said. They said that all the evidence in that a traditional marriage, husband, wife, and children, is the best environment for human thriving. And so therefore voted to promote that. Now, at the same time, they also argued against discrimination for people who didn't agree with that and argued that those rights should not be discriminated against, but they pushed the family forward. 27 nations voted in favor and 14 voted against. Guess who the 14 are that voted against it? The U.S. and the European nations. Very interesting what you read when you read about what the rest of the world feels about that. And the threats about withholding aid and all kinds of things that took place in there. For those of you who study history, you know that Russia and China, who both voted for this, went through a significant period of time under communism where taking the children away from the family and raising them institutionally was very much part of their thinking and their culture. They have made a reversal on that because they realize the human wreckage that comes when the family is not intact. It's an international discussion. It's also a national discussion. And here's why it's a national discussion. Because currently, it's being positioned that people who don't agree with this are haters. And haters are dangerous for society. And so we've already seen this begin to play out. Last year, the CEO of Mozilla, a major technology company, was forced to resign under pressure because 10 years earlier, he had given $1,000 quietly to Proposition 8 in California, which was the thing that the state actually voted to affirm the male-female husband-wife role in marriage. And when he gave that money, he was actually giving to the same cause that the President of the United States publicly supported. And yet the company forced him to resign because of that. Last week, a chaplain in Kentucky was told that if he wouldn't sign a statement promising to never mention homosexual sex as sinful, that he could no longer be a chaplain, and he couldn't sign that personally. It was against his conscience. So he was fired. That Christian chaplain can no longer work with the juveniles that he's been working with. So this has got a big issue nationally. It's going to play out in 1,000 different court cases nationally over time. In addition to that, it's very personal. I'd be very surprised if there's anybody in here that doesn't have a working relationship with, a friendship with, a neighbor, or even a family member that's not part of the LGBT community. And that's very personal. These are people we know, people that we care about, people we live around. And since between 2 and 4% of the population would identify themselves with a same-sex attraction, there are people in this room right now who would identify themselves with the LGBT community. They just would. And so this is a very personal thing. It's not a political thing, though there's politics about it. It's very personal. So in the midst of all of this conversation, we're going to dive in and have a discussion about this. It's kind of a risky thing to do in church, right? But we're going to dive in. So let me just give you guys a couple disclaimers right from the beginning. Might as well get it out there and let you guys know. First thing I want you guys to know is I'm not naive enough to think that in three sermons, we're going to talk about love this week, we'll talk about what is marriage next week, and we'll talk about why kids, that we're going to cover, unless you guys are willing to stay longer than the 40 minutes, so I'm going to give it, you know, that we're going to cover all of the issues. There are going to be lots of issues that we don't get to. I just say that right up front. In addition to that, I want you guys to know, and this is very important to know, I am not promoting a political agenda. I think the church is above and separate from the government. And so I'm not going to get you all into some kind of a rally, pro or con, and, you know, we're going to all go out and march on Washington. That's not my role. We're not going to do that. Now, some of you guys may be really upset with that, but I'm not going to do that. I want you also to know that we're not going to rewrite the Bible. I don't think we have the authority here to rewrite the Bible and take out verses that have been in there for 2,000 years as if we have the authority to do that. We're not going to do that. I know that's going to bother some people. They're going to want, some of you are going to want me to rewrite the Bible and change it to fit contemporary culture. In addition to that, I want you to know that you probably won't agree with everything I say. And so I'm going to ask you for something. I know that the majority of us hate living in a soundbite world. Like, complicated issues require intelligent people to sit down and listen to multiple sides of the discussion, and so that we can think rationally and logically, and mature people do that. But we don't see that many people doing that at a national, political, cultural level. And the reason why they don't, why we live in a soundbite world, everybody wants to craft their little sentence and not have an open discussion, is because there's so many people that are so offended by hearing something that they don't like that everybody capitulates to that. And so we kind of try to like get it into a little statement and not say more or less instead of having a real discussion. And so if halfway through a sentence, you guys hear me say something that you think you know what I'm going to say and you don't like it and you get out and run for the door, you're probably not going to get it. You're probably not going to get it. I mean, you got to listen. So part of our maturity is being able to actually listen to stuff that maybe we don't agree with, and in the process of that, get another perspective. So I'm not saying you can't get up and go to the bathroom. Okay, because you guys all hydrated, right? I get that. So, but I'm encouraging you to be willing to hang in there, because here's the crazy thing. I have people leave in the middle of one of my sentences and then tell me, here's what I think, and I'll say, if you'd have listened to the rest of the paragraph, you wouldn't have come away with that conclusion. You wouldn't have come away with that conclusion. So anyway, that's just fair, right? It's fair in the kind of discussion that we're having here. So I want you also to know the tone at which Hill Country Bible Church approaches these kind of conversations. I became aware of the need to define tone a while ago. We every year go around to our neighborhood and give Christmas candy to our neighbors. And when we give Christmas candy to our neighbors, we always invite them to our Christmas Eve service. And so I went over to the house of one of my gay neighbors, and we gave him Christmas candy. We were chatting a bit there, and I said, love to have you for our Christmas Eve service. And he stopped me, and he said, oh, I didn't know that your church was open for someone like me to visit. And all of a sudden I realized there's this huge perception out there that if you don't fit a certain mold, you're not welcome. So let me just read to you a few statements about what we actually think about people so you can get the tone. Here's the first one. God does not love any of us more or less than another. He sacrificed his only son for all of us. Every human being holds infinite worth in the eyes of Christ, even those that you may disagree with. Here's another one. This is important. We have room for those who struggle to honor God's standard of purity, for it is a high standard indeed. Get that? We have room for those who struggle, because my guess is that would include every single person sitting in this room. We want to communicate what we believe Scripture teaches about these matters, but we also want to extend grace, a listening ear and a compassionate heart to everyone, regardless of where you may be on your spiritual journey. So we're going to talk truth. We're going to talk it in grace. If you disagree with our truth and you become ungracious, which is the popular kind of approach out there, you're not any better than the people who in the past railed with truth on certain behaviors and certain approaches to life with no love involved, okay? So the Bible says grace and love, they go together. Here's an important one. We may let you down with our words, our attitudes, and our prejudices, but Jesus' capacity to understand, forgive, and redeem is greater, far greater than us, and he will never let you down. So Hill Country Bible Church is not perfect. We're made up of imperfect people. And there are people here that will be hurt along the way by us, how we act, what we do, what we say. But Jesus is not us. He's much, much different. In fact, we're all here to follow him and try to lean into him. So having said that, as my really lengthy introduction here, what I want to do is ask and answer the question today, what does the Bible say is the definition of love? What is love in the Bible? And I want to take you to a chapter that lays this out in 1 John chapter 4. So one of Jesus' closest disciples, John, in 1 John chapter 4, writes about what love is. If you don't have a Bible, we've got them all around the room. Don't be embarrassed to get up and go get one. Or you can get online here and go to BibleGateway.org and pull up a Bible there so you can actually see what does the Bible say about these things. And in 1 John chapter 4, starting in verse 7, he says this. He says, "Dear friends, let us love one another, for love comes from God. Everyone who loves has been born of God and knows God. Whoever does not love does not know God, because," here's the phrase, "God is love." In other words, the basic message of the Bible is this: God is the source of love. God is the source of love. When it says God is love, that means in the way he operates, in his personal thinking, in his personal approach, that love is his basic operating system. That's how he approaches the world. That's how he approaches every situation. It emanates from him. Here's the danger. The danger is when we turn that around, when we say, oh, if God is love, then love is God. And people make that logical fallacy all the time. It's called the fallacy of affirming the converse. Some of you love that. You love logic. Others of you say, if I lived by logic, it'd ruin my whole life. So whenever we turn it around and say love is God, then we say things like this. Well, how could a loving God ever, and you fill in the blank. See what you've just done? Is you've now become God, because you own the definition of love and you project it onto God, and now you begin to shape who he is based on your cultural, personal definition of the word. That's not what we're here to do today. What we're here to do today is to understand what God's definition of love is. In other words, what does it look like that God is love? How does he define it? Now, in order for us to do that, I want to contrast our current cultural definition of love, particularly when it comes to love between two individuals, the love that brings two people together and dating, romantic, married, that kind of love. What does that look like? How do we define that culturally? And here's my cultural definition. My cultural definition is love is a feeling. Love is also a drive. Love is sexual intimacy. Love is an irrational impulse. Let me explain. Love is a feeling. How many times have you asked somebody, why do you love them? And the answer is because they make me feel and fill in the blank. In other words, I love somebody because of what they do for me, how they make me feel. That's common when we're talking about relational love. Love is also a drive. People feel like I can't help myself. Well, like I'm with that person. Why? I'm driven to them. You know, two men look at a woman. One man looks at a woman and says, wow, there's my future. That's the face that launches 1,000 ships. Another man looks at the same woman and says, that's my past. That's the face that sunk 1,000 ships. So what's the deal there? It's this feeling, this drive, I'm drawn to this person. I'm drawn to that person. That's love. I'm repulsed by that person. I'm not in love anymore. We're done with that. Sexual intimacy. When we talk about love or sexual intimacy, oftentimes we call it making love, don't we? In fact, what we tell two young people today oftentimes is, well, if you really, really love each other, like you really are in love with each other, that's the moment when crossing the line into a sexual relationship is now deemed okay. Many messages go out to say that today. Love is an irrational impulse. It feels out of control. It feels out of control. And we get this, right? Because this is actually part of the human experience. The source of this kind of love, we would call the source the heart. It's the desire. It's the need-based love. And that drives most of our discussion around this concept of love. It occupies a lot of real estate in our brain. In fact, when we use the word love, these things that I just mentioned, oftentimes they come up and they occupy a lot of real estate. So even without thinking about it many times, they just kind of stick in our heads. And when this definition of love sticks in our head, you might think, well, that's so awesome. Why would anybody want to keep anybody from not experiencing that? Why would anybody want to keep anybody from not experiencing that? That seems like exactly like a wonderful thing that drives our culture. But there's a warning in this passage. And I want you to see in chapter 4, verse 1, he says, dear friends, do not believe every spirit, but test the spirits to see whether they are from God, because many false prophets have gone out into the world. In other words, every message that you're receiving is not necessarily true. Every definition that our culture defines isn't necessarily right. There are false prophets out there, and they occupy all different kinds of lecterns. They're not just in a pulpit someplace. They're all over the place. So he calls us to be discerning when it comes to this issue of love to make sure that we get the right definition. In fact, look at what he says in verse 5. He says, they're from the world and therefore speak from the viewpoint of the world and the world listens to them. See that circular activity? They emerge from the culture with a cultural definition. They speak it back to the culture. The culture pats them on the back for saying what everybody wants to hear, and then gives them a platform to say it. In other words, it's just groupthink. Everybody seems to be saying and thinking the same thing, so we go out and find people in our culture that will stand up and tell us all what we want to hear. And John says that's dangerous. It's dangerous to primarily listen to the people that are like you, which means some of you probably need to change your cable news channel for a little while and just hear the other side of the story. It may surprise you. It may not. Maybe you should just turn it off and do something better. But, you know, that's probably not going to happen. So, anyway, let's move then to a different way of thinking. The word that's used in this passage for love occurs 28 times in one chapter. You'd say, this looks like the love chapter, right? 28 times in one chapter. It's the word in the Greek, agape. Now, I'm going to give you a little bit of background on this word, a little historical background, literary background. When I do that, 12 of you are going to be so excited. The rest of you, hang in there with me, okay? This may make some sense to you. There were three words for love in classical Greek. Classical Greek is during the time of Homer, 900 years before Christ. And three of those words, two of them were used frequently, and they were very powerful in their language. The first one is the word eros. Eros is the word that refers to the pulsating, driving passion of sexual love. And that was a powerful, powerful thing in the culture of Greece. The second word, phileo, is the word that refers to kind of affection or brotherly love. It's the kind of love that you have for your kinfolk, for your brother, for your sister, for the fraternity that you hung out with for 4 years with those guys, or the sorority, for the combat troop that you fought with. It's that deep, platonic, sacrificial, like, I love you, I feel for you when we're together, you make me happy. Phileo, that's the second type of love. The third love, agape, was seldom used. It wasn't a very powerful word in the culture. It actually had something to do with freedom, free will, choosing. So when the rabbis wanted to translate the Old Testament into Greek so that the Jews that were scattered and were learning Greek and living Greek since that was the language of the empire, when they wanted to translate the Old Testament, they had to find a word to translate the Hebrew concept or the Hebrew word that referred to God, the word ahav. How do we translate ahav into Greek? Eros won't do. It doesn't fit the context. Phileo won't do. It doesn't fit the context. Those were the most popular. Ah, what about agape? And so they landed on agape. Now, I spent time on this because in seminary, I wrote a paper on ahav, the Hebrew word for love, every use of it in the whole Old Testament. And that was a real bummer, and I've got my paper if you want to read it. I mean, I'm sure, like in all these years of ministry, nobody's ever asked me for that, but since, you know, I might as well share something with you that I learned along the way. So anyway, this word ahav is this very interesting word. It's the word that implies freedom to choose. Now you say, well, that doesn't sound like a very sexy word. Like choose? Is there no emotion involved in it? Actually, quite the opposite. It's the kind of emotion that's involved in adoption. When a family decides that they're going to open up their home to a child they don't even know yet. Love is not conditioned on their affection for the child. They've not met the child yet. But they decide that they want to adopt, and they go and they pick a child. And then they begin, out of their free will, to shower their affection and their resources and their love upon this child. That's the word agape. That's the word ahav. And that's the word that's used of God. God is not bound by any need or desire that he has to have you approve of him. You give something to him. You serve him in some way. God's love is completely others directed. In other words, the word ahav or the word agape here that's used in the Greek, it doesn't come from the heart. It doesn't come from the desires. It actually comes from the person, the self, the soul, which is why it's very interesting in our culture that we would actually create a self-identity around our desire, that we would label ourselves based on our sexual preferences or our sexual desires, that we would say, that's who I am, because we're bigger than that. There's more to us than that. Greater than our desires. And yet in our culture, we do that. We define ourselves as, I'm attractive. And that's the psyche of who we are. I'm smart. And that's the psyche of who we are. We're way bigger than that. So this idea that God loves means that God chooses. In fact, let me give you the whole idea here. The biblical concept of love or definition is this. Love is a free choice to commit my life to your thriving. Love is a free choice to commit my life to your thriving. Look at verses 7 and 8 again. Dear friends, let us love one another. How? For love comes from God. Everyone who loves has been born of God and knows God. Whoever does not love does not know God, because God is love. The call here is that we would approach every other person on the planet with a preference to choose to do good by them, to give them what they need, not to look for what we need. So here's the profound difference. A person stands at the altar to make a lifelong commitment to another person. And as they stand at the altar to make this commitment, you ask them the question, why are you doing this? The cultural view says, I can't help myself because he completes me. I have to have him because he completes me. I need him. It's a need love. That's desire. Agape love, commitment love, says the opposite. Why are you marrying this person? Because out of all the men on the planet, I choose you. I pick you. And I'm going to love you regardless of what I get back. I'm going to pour into you to give you what you need. You see the difference between the two? Huge difference. A huge difference. At that point in time, now we're starting to talk about a different quality of love. A different quality, a different existence, a different experience, a different approach, a different commitment. Human love, the kind of love we talk about, is primarily needs-based. And because it's primarily needs-based, we find ourselves in this really weird bipolar thing. Like, I meet somebody, and they're attractive to me, and they seem wonderful, and they seem to get my jokes, and they put time into me, and they look at me, and all of a sudden, I'm up in this mantic phase. It's just wonderful. I'm driven by this. I got to have that person. And then we get them. And we find out that much of what we felt and saw and thought was actually me projecting my needs and my desires onto them, and we find out that they're human, and we devolve into this state of depression. Like, wow, this isn't what I thought. So what do? Well, like, I find somebody else, and boom, here I go again. I'm back in the mantic stage of, wow, everything's wonderful and perfect. And that one was clearly, I was just immature and I was young, and like, that person, you know, I just picked the wrong one. But over time, you start to realize the same thing again, and you realize that a relationship can't be built on that. A needs-based, satisfy me, fulfill me, do what I need. You can't be built on that. And so, like, our music is littered with songs about this stuff. I mean, I'm like a Righteous Brothers era. You've lost that love and feeling. You know, it's gone, 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 and I can't go on. Oh. I know some of you are younger than me, so like, I could bring out the Taylor Swift songs, but every single one of them talks about this, and so, you know, that's problematic. Or if you go with the Katy Perry approach, like, those are just kind of bizarre and crazy people songs. So, but it's our world is littered with this Wuthering Heights kind of feeling that we need something in order to make us happy, to satisfy us. And because of that, we're driven by individual choices to satisfy us in our relationships and to have our needs met, and therefore our needs begin to define us. But we actually don't live in a solo world. And oftentimes we want to ignore the fact that every decision I make not only affects me, but it affects the people around me. And here's what's so amazing about God. God has the ability to look at you and take into consideration, how do I help you thrive as an individual, as well as at the same time holding in balance how your behavior affects everyone else. You say, I don't get that. Well, just think like Wall Street in 2008. Many, many individuals benefited. Many, many individuals got clobbered. Okay, so what we do not only affects us, but it affects other people as well. And so We have to ask ourselves the question, is our definition of love both beneficial for the individual and beneficial for society as well? So let me just raise some questions and let you know that I realize that I'm going to step right into it right here, okay? Since second marriages fail at a higher rate than first, is it more loving to affirm those considering divorce or to support them in learning to love like God loves? That's a question to consider. Here's another one. Since the highest pregnancy rates occur in teens that identify themselves as LGBT, I know some of you are shocked by that. Highest pregnancy rate in teens occurs by those who identify themselves as LGBT. Is it loving to sexualize the teen experience to promote more acceptance of LGBT people in society? That's a real important question. Here's another one. Since 70 to 80% of children who struggle with gender identity move through this phase and become comfortable with their biological identity by around age 18 or 19, is it loving to promote sexual reassignment surgery to 15-year-olds? These are real important questions. Now, some of you are saying, well, where did you get that information? I can tell you right now, you're not going to get that information in the popular media, press, or magazines. I mean, we have real people wrestling with real issues here. And hashtag Love Wins doesn't even begin to delve into the depth of what we're wrestling with here. 41% of people who are struggling with their identity as teenagers, I mean, I would say almost 100% of teenagers struggle with their identity, right? But 41% who struggle with their identity around gender commit or attempt to commit suicide. So there are serious issues about working with kids that have gender dysmorphia. It's a real deal. But on the flip side, after massive studies have been done with lots of people who have actually, as adults, had sexual reassignment surgery, at the 10-year point, those who've had that reassignment surgery are 20 times more likely to attempt suicide than the general population at that point in time. Have we done anything to help a person by changing the appearance of their biology? These are really important problems that we have to wrestle with. And unfortunately, it's hard to even have this discussion in the politically correct world to ask what's best for the individual and people, because we as a culture have so defined love based on desire, on the heart, on our feelings, that oftentimes we actually overlook what people need. Let me show you what God does with this issue. Look back at the passage. In verse 9, he says, this is how God showed his love among us. He sent his one and only Son into the world that we might live through him. God doesn't ignore these individual or societal problems. God sends Jesus into the world, his one and only Son. He didn't send angels. He didn't send a human representative. He actually came personally to walk among us, to experience every temptation, everything we've been through. And then he goes on to say this. Verse 10, this is love. Not that we love God, but that he loved us and sent his Son as an atoning sacrifice for our sin. There's the big S word, sin. In other words, God doesn't define love as affirming people in their desires. God defines love as transforming people through his sacrifice. God loves all of us too much to leave us in the place where our desires take us, whether it's sexual, whether it's the desire for money, for approval, all of us live in the brokenness of our own sin. Every one of us. Just because you might hold the tag heterosexual doesn't mean that you've got it together. In fact, I would say the majority of heterosexuals have, let me just say, anybody that carries genetics has an issue with sexual desire. It's just real. It's real for all of us. And in the midst of that, God didn't just say, okay, guys, I'm going to sit back and ping you, ping you, ping you, or ping that group, ping that group, ping that group. What God did was he sent his son into the world, and Jesus Christ died for all the victims, and he died on behalf of all the victimizers and took the punishment for our sin. And so here's what the Bible says. Would you surrender to the love of God? Entrust yourself to his love, a transforming love, and let him reshape you, whatever your issues are, reshape you into the image that he has for you. Or do you demand that whatever image you have for yourself, you're going to stay there, and everybody around you needs to affirm you in that? The message of the love of the Bible is that God, through the power of his love, can move us into the kind of person that he's called us to be, regardless of who we are, where we come from. But if we don't surrender to that love, if the God who adopts, picks us, chooses us, comes on our behalf, overwhelms us with his love, transfers us into the kingdom of righteousness, if you don't submit or surrender to that love, you're not going to experience the transformation. While our culture says, let's just affirm and stay where we are, God's love says, no, come, surrender to me, and I'll take you places that you cannot imagine you could ever go in my love. I want us to just bow our heads and have a moment here to get personal. I ask you to bow your head just simply to block out the people around you, give you a chance to be personal. Is there anything that you're holding on to, no matter what it is today, that's got you stuck? And you're saying, Tim, are you serious? Like, if I will truly surrender to Jesus' love, that he can transform me? I talked to a guy this morning, 11 years sober today. He said, it wasn't until I surrendered to the love of God. 11 years on a new path, transformed. God can do that for all of us. I just invite you in this moment to take whatever it is that's holding you back and just say, God, you can have this. I want your transforming love to liberate me.